As I was saying, we were talking about the spectrum of rabbis giving their views on Judaism. As one might have expected, the Reform rabbis perceived Judaism as essentially a social conscience or moral reform movement. The Orthodox rabbis perceived of Judaism as a continuity with the past. For them, I think the past was seen in terms of the Jewish civilization, which they believed existed 100 years ago in, quote, the old country, unquote. But to the old country was a sort of a romanticized version of the shtetl, or a romanticized version of Vilna, Warsaw, or perhaps Frankfurt. Since I was chairing the session, I would always ask, I took the liberty, or more accurately, I demanded to ask the first question. And the first question I asked was always the same. What impact do you think that Judaism has had on American civilization? And what interested me the most was that, with the exception of one Orthodox rabbi, the question seemed to them to be irrelevant. Why should Judaism, why should be expected to influence American civilization? The Reform rabbis invariably believed that the New Deal, or the kind of social welfare concern which emerged in the 1930s, was Judaism at its best. The weakness of the conservative rabbinate, I thought, was manifested by the superficiality of the knowledge of the rabbis, the conservative rabbis, when asked this question. Well, this leads me to a very interesting a question that is of very great interest to me. In the earliest issue of Commentary magazine, in the late 1940s, Daniel Burstyn, who was then professor at the University of Chicago, and more recently has been a librarian of Congress, wrote a book review of a collection of the major essays written by Mr. Justice Benjamin Cardozo, the second Jew appointed to the United States Supreme Court. Cardozo is legendary amongst lawyers for his legal craftsmanship. He was also considered to be a master legal stylist. Burstyn's review fascinated me, because Burstyn said, is there anything Jewish in Justice Cardozo's work? We all know that he was a Jewish judge. We all know that Mr. Justice McReynolds not only read a newspaper during the swearing-in ceremony of Justice Cardozo, but he was heard to say, these days you can only get on the court if you're a Jew or if your father was a crook. It so happened that Cardozo's father had been sent to jail as a Tammany politician. And in the case of Justice Cardozo, said Justice McReynolds, it's both. But what Burstyn points out is that there was nothing Jewish in Cardozo. Cardozo's judgments were in the best Anglo-Saxon or Anglo-American legal tradition. It was nothing Jewish there. This idea hit me like a ton of bricks. Many years later, when I was asked to write an essay on Jews and economics as part of the 1976 bicentennial celebration of Adam Smith's Wealth of publication of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. I wrote such an article in which I said, is there such a thing as a Jewish contribution to modern economics? And this article, which was published initially in Judaism, is a theme which I have taken up since then. My general argument was that, yes, certain types of Russian Jews brought to American economics a taste for a non-teleological interpretation of the historical process. Non-teleological. Teleological means deterministic. And I use as an example of this in this article the work of my father and the work of Simon Kuznets, both men having been trained initially in a Talmud Torah, both being very bright young men, then having gone to Tsarist gymnasiums where they were taught the theory of history from the standpoint of the Russian Orthodox Church. The Jewish non-teleological history had been pretty well grounded in them as boys. While they were in the Russian gymnasium, they turned to the Menshevik Marxian doctrines of historical determinism. And having left Europe, they came to America, where they were became apprentices to economists who emphasized empirical investigation. And they were looking for a historical treatment which had a gestalt, but which was empirically verifiable. And each man developed his own approach, and I said this variety of approaches.
Kuznets, was it?
I'm sorry?
Did you say Kuznets?
Kuznets, yes. Each man developed his own approach, which had in it a desire to combine empiricism with some general historical lessons. The old historical lessons forming, as I say, a theory. Now, in both cases, each man thought his theory was explanatory, but only satisfying to himself. Each man thought that his theory was not a world-beating general theory. So my point in all of this thing is that each man's really brought to the study of economics the impact of a Jewish setting up of the problem in what I thought was essentially a product of the Russian Jewish intellectual experience of that class of immigrant Jews. By the time I had published this article, my father was long dead, but I do recall having a discussion with him about the Burstyn Review and his immediate recognition of the importance of the Burstyn approach. I do not recall what his views were on that subject. It may well have been that my views on the subject were originally shaped in discussion with him. I just don't remember. I talked about this at considerable length with Kuznets over many hours of discussion. Kuznets bought the proposition.
Bought it.
But in buying it, I think he was less confident that there was anything inherently Jewish in what I was saying as it was inherently Russian Jewish. In other words, he was saying, what you are really predicating your argument on is the historical intellectual experience of this group of young Jews who were being exposed to Western, or in any case, we'll say Western Christian culture, being exposed in a series of very soul-searing experiences. And I would buy that. I would think that that's a correct point. So that's the as far as I would go on that subject.
Dr. Perlman, a word about some thought or thoughts, your thoughts on the United Jewish Federation during whoever's tenure as president, you might recall.
Again, I may be repeating myself because these interviews have gone over a longer period than my memory span seems to handle these days. When we came to Pittsburgh, the educational director of the YMHA, Morton Rosenbaum, I should have said the educational director was Morton Rosenbaum. Rosenbaum and my wife Naomi had known each other since childhood. Indeed, the Rosenbaums and the Waxmans shared or had cottages at the same beach in Michigan City, Indiana during the summer months, and the friendships of the family were great. Morton Rosenbaum and my brother-in-law Mordecai Waxman both objected to the fact that their names were hardly common, and they had gotten into the habit of calling each other John as part of the effort to be more American. Wart Rosenbaum, as an individual, can only be described as bizarre. He looked bizarre, he talked bizarre, he was bizarre. On the other hand, he was also very bright. But he was a thorn in the side of the administrators of the YMHA. Shortly after I came here, Morton asked if I would give some lectures in his lecture series, a series which regretfully, which I regret, has long since been abandoned. And I did so, and I was on the board of his group, one or more of his groups. Eventually, I was on the board of the YMHA. During the period that I was on the board of the YMHA, I realized that an effort was being made to fire him. Rosenbaum was a man who, as I said, had highly idiosyncratic habits, and was a man of a very complicated personal life. In any case, I had made it clear to the president of the board. I made it clear to the president of the board that if he was going to fire Rosenbaum, would he notify me beforehand so that I would drop off the board. I did not want to be a member of the board which fired a long-term friend of my wife's family. This request was received, acknowledged, but ignored. And when Rosenberg was fired, I resigned.
Was it Rosenberg?
Rosenbaum. I resigned. In the course of that period, the United Jewish Federation leader, whose name I'm forgetting at the moment, talked to me about why they were going to fire Rosenbaum. I think that what I said to him simply was that it was a matter of considerable embarrassment to me. I could understand why they were doing it. I could understand why Rosenbaum felt that they were doing it unfairly. But it was not a situation which, personally, I could handle. I couldn't change Rosenbaum, and I couldn't agree with the decision to fire a man who was in his early 60s, who had been in the community for 30 years, for all 30 years.
Soroka was...
Is it Gerald Soroka?
Gerald Soroka.
Gerald Soroka understood my position. And when he was retired from the leadership of the United Jewish Federation, and was replaced by a man by the name of Khan, I think, a local man who had been very successful elsewhere and left Pittsburgh to go to become the director, I believe, in New York or some much larger
community. Cleveland.
Was it Cleveland?
They all came from Cleveland.
No.
Soroka did the successors.
No. Khan, he was in Pittsburgh, well, at least as I recall. He was very kind and offered me, came to see me in my office at the university, and he suggested having lunch, and he had lunch several times. And I talked to him at considerable length about what interested me in the Jewish community. And my impression was he took what I was saying as something as being quite original and something well worth considering. I don't think that necessarily I ever believed that he would buy everything I said lock, stock, and barrel, but it was an interesting point. I, at that point, was most interested in making Montefiore into a Jewish hospital. Now, here is a rather interesting point. I was a professor. I had an appointment as in the Department of Public Health Administration at Pitt, and I had some ideas about hospital investment. Now, one of the things that had bothered me very much about Montefiore, and during this period about the whole Jewish Federation, was that they were tremendously concerned with black Jewish relationships. I remember arguing with Mrs. Reisenstein very heatedly that the purpose of the Jewish community was not to improve black Jewish relationships. It is not that I thought that black Jewish relationships were unimportant, but that the community had its own agenda, which included far more important issues. Specifically, the issues which I was most concerned with was the lack of recognition that the late 60s, with the introduction of the drug culture and the introduction of new views in regard to the openness of sexual relationships amongst young people, presented some major health problems to the Jewish community. And I thought that the Montefiore Hospital should be pushed into focusing on that. Khan, or whatever that man's name was, and I'm again embarrassed that I don't remember it, Khan suggested that I talk to to Emanuel Goldberg, who was the very able director of the Montefiore Hospital, and Goldberg, whom I knew because my mother-in-law had been in the hospital repeatedly, invited me down for a luncheon, and we talked for a very long time. I imagine it was a three-hour conversation. What I really had as my own personal agenda were the implementation of the program plus membership on the hospital board. Now, let it not be said that I'm not aware of my own motives. My mother-in-law was alive in those days, and she was in the hospital off and on for reasons relating to a gangrenous leg, which eventually had to be amputated. And the hospital was always in the position of forcing her out when the medical treatment was not immediately seen as necessary. And if I was a board member, the speed with which she would be forced out would be somewhat minimized. And I make no apologies for the essential inequity or unfairness of this sort of thing. I believe that when you're dealing with an old person who's dying by inches, one does anything to, one is driven to doing anything. In any event, I talked at length to Goldberg and told him about the general views that I had, that the original reason for Jewish hospitals was, were two. One was, principally, to give Jewish doctors a place to put their patients. And secondly, if the patients, insofar as the patients were observant Jews, the hospital should provide what was considered minimal Jewish service, namely kosher food. I said that I thought that the role of a Jewish hospital ought to be somewhat different. Not only should they offer, they have a place for Jewish doctors to practice, it was no longer as important because Jews were now accepted even at Presbyterian University Hospital. Not only should they give kosher food, which was less important than it had been, because kosher food was available in virtually every other hospital in the city, but they ought to say to the patients coming in, we are a Jewish hospital, and unless you specifically do not want it, we wish to give you what we consider to be a Jewish approach to medicine, namely that medical problems are not the patient's problem, but the problems of the patient's family as well, and that we want to treat the situation from the standpoint of the family involvement. Now, specifically, I said, this involves not only the social work services, which you're already giving to families who are burdened with older people who are dying by inches, where you help them find a nursing home or you help them find a visiting nurse situation. I said, but you must come to grips with the fact that you have an increasingly large number of medical risks amongst adolescents, and that you should build up a major adolescent clinic. A major adolescent clinic coping with the two manifestations, I think I said at that time the three manifestations of our modern Jewish adolescence. The greater exposure to drugs, meaning of that, of course, what is in those days were marijuana and mind expanding drugs.
LSD.
LSD and that sort of thing. Of course, I was aware that hard drugs like cocaine were available. Secondly, I said you have to make them tremendously aware of the great problems of sexual promiscuity. Of course, this was well before the era of AIDS. But I was concerned about sexual promiscuity in terms of affecting fertility through gonorrhea and syphilis infections and other venereal disease infections. And thirdly, I said that you have to recognize that there's a great deal of emotional instability amongst these youngsters. This was before the period, this was during the period when there was the first efforts were made at group therapy. I wasn't particularly aware of the advantages or disadvantages of group therapy as such, but I thought that the emotional problems of the Jewish kids were seen in terms of their dropping out of academic work, even if they are registered at universities, to get involved in various kinds of reform issues, whether it was anti-Vietnam or whether it was civil rights or whether it was concern about what I used to call in those days Red Indians, of course we now call them Native Americans. It was not a period when we were terribly brought up about Hispanic Americans, except Puerto Ricans coming to New York. In any event, Goldberg listened to me very seriously, said he would get back to me, and I'm still waiting. Of course, by now, Bonifiore has been sold to Presbyterian University, and much of the money that was given to the Jewish community in that, by Presbyterian University in that sale has been used to try to develop things with America, with Jewish youth.
Ladies Hospital Aid kept its money.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
They're using it for their own purposes.
Yeah. But what bothered me very much in this period is that the Federation not only did not respond to these ideas, and perhaps they were seriously discussed, I don't know, they have made an effort to incorporate me. I have made an effort to explain what interested me, and I'm afraid that the best thing that can be said is I didn't impress them at all, and I'm afraid they didn't impress me at all. Later, Sidney Busis, who had been my nose surgeon. I had some problems with the deviated septum, and whom I liked very much, asked me if I, he was about to become president of the Federation, asked me if I would help run the drive at the university, and I said no. I said I did not have the time or the interest. And I think he asked me why, and I think I said simply the following, that to run the drive at the university means that one is, they should be terribly committed to what the Federation is doing. And I'm not committed to what the Federation is doing. I was at that point an officer of Beth Sholem, and I felt very keenly then that the Federation was not taking enough interest in the synagogal centers. It was running and financing the Hebrew Institute, which I thought was put a burden, an economic burden on the synagogues that ran Hebrew programs at the, for the late afternoons for Jewish children. And that was the end of that. I had also been solicited by the by Hyman Kimmel, who was running the American Zionist organization. Kimmel was a strange, for me, a strange man. He was essentially a fundraiser and administrator. He approached me as the moment I became the chairman of the economics department and wanted me to go on his board, which I did. A board of the American Zionist Organization here in Pittsburgh. He wanted me he wanted to talk to me about getting a doctorate in economics, and I quickly established the point that there was no personal advantage to approaching the subject through me, but the academic rules. I think he was also interested in getting a doctorate at Gispio, which I know a little about. And I remained a member of the American Zionist Organization for some years until I still pay my membership. But I went off the board after one term. I mentioned earlier that I was on the board for one term of the American Jewish Committee, but my services on there were only for one term. I was on the board of the for one
term. Who was the president when you were on the American Committee board?
I do not remember. Mm. I was on the board for one term of the Young People's Congregation, but I don't think I was an easy board member. I remember Al Bloom and I had the job of dividing up funds for charitable organizations, and in retrospect, I announced a formula, and it probably would have been better had I negotiated the formula. In any case, the formula was accepted, but I feel that I was not considered an easy board member. So that is really pretty much the picture that I have of my relationship with Jewish organizations in this city. I have not, I've never considered a membership in any of the Jewish country clubs or swimming clubs or the Concordia Club, and that is not a reason of policy, it's just that I'm not interested in those kinds of activities, and nor am I particularly interested in the social relationships I would strike up. I don't say this with any sense of I'm better than that sort of thing. It's just not my it's not an area in which I operate easily. We've been talking the last few minutes when the machine was off about the division in the, or the focus in the organization of Jewish cities. and Mr. Braun mentioned that the leadership in Pittsburgh has traditionally been a commercial leadership, commerce perhaps being, in this case, principally mercantile rather than industrial, although there were two or three major Jewish industrial families here. And Mrs. Saul remarked that, well, of course, Pittsburgh is nothing like the bigger Jewish communities like New York. And I suppose I would add more recently Los Angeles, which is even bigger than New York. Well, my point was, is that from the standpoint of city size, this organization around a commercial leadership is standard. Mr. Braun commented that leads to a division between town and gown, and of course that's correct. But I went on to say that I thought that the only unique city in America from the standpoint of Jewish leadership